From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The second summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump ended without an agreement. There was some finger-pointing back and forth over who was responsible, and the U.S. media, of course, agrees it was President Trump. Today, we take a look at how it's seen in China, beginning first with this report from China's global television network CGTN's White House correspondent Jessica Stone, who was in Hanoi for the summit.
If Singapore was about symbolism, Hanoi was supposed to be about outcomes.
There are people who hold a skeptical view of our meeting, and for them, I think watching us have a great time will be like watching a scene from a fantasy movie.
And if the DPRK nuclear talks are a movie, there's no ending yet. DPRK leader Kim Jong-un says he is willing to denuclearize.
If I'm not willing to do that, I won't be here right now.
But his demands are too high for Washington. Thursday afternoon, talks broke down. The signing ceremony was canceled. The White House moved up the time for the presidential press conference.
Sometimes you have to walk. And this was just one of those times.
During the press conference, U.S. President Donald Trump said the major sticking point in negotiations came down to the Yongbyon nuclear facility. He says Kim Jong-un was willing to fully denuclearize that facility, but only in exchange for a full lifting of all U.S. sanctions.
They wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, and we couldn't do that. They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that.
For Trump, the effort is not a lost cause. He says he's grateful to the other nations who've pushed Pyongyang to engage and levied the punishing sanctions that led to the talks.
How would you describe China's role in facilitating the engagement that's happened so far between Pyongyang and Washington?
I think China's been a big help, bigger than most people know. On the border, as you know, 93% of the goods coming into North Korea come through China. So there's a great power there. At the same time, I happen to believe that North Korea is calling its own shots and not taking orders from anybody. He's a very strong guy.
A strong guy whom Trump says he respects. A relationship he believes will lead to progress long term. But for now, the U.S. president leaves Hanoi without a deal, without a commitment to a next summit. Jessica Stone, CGTN, Hanoi, Vietnam.
And now we bring you this conversation from CGTN's program, The Heat, moderated by journalist Sean Calebs.
Okay, we have lots to unpack here. We're going to get straight to our panel. Brian Becker joins us from Hanoi. He is an analyst on U.S. DPRK relations and has visited the DPRK on several occasions. Also joining us from Beijing, Victor Gao. He is vice president of the Center for China and Globalization. And here in Washington, D.C., David Jonas. He is an adjunct professor at George Washington University and an international expert on nuclear non-proliferation law. Thank you all for being here. Brian, I want to start with you. This is a case of he said, he said. Who is right in all this? Donald Trump saying that the DPRK was adamant about getting the sanctions removed, whereas Trump says that the DPRK wanted wanted the United States to do more. Give us your feeling on how this played out and where do we go from here?
Well, I think if you listen carefully to the words of Mike Pompeo as well as Donald Trump, what they said is that North Korea was willing to close down the Yongbyon nuclear facility, have a permanent enduring suspension or end to nuclear testing and missile testing, which was something new, but that the U.S. wanted them to do more. That was the do more. I don't think that Kim Jong-un came all the way by train from Pyongyang to have this talk collapse. I think what happened is that there were additional demands placed on the DPRK, and the DPRK was not prepared to accept them. I think the United States basically moved the goalposts back. And the question is why? We know that within the Trump administration, there are people like John Bolton, for instance, who actually don't want this deal, who actually played a major role in sabotaging the General Framework Agreement back in 2002 when George W. Bush was president and he was an advisor. That's when Bush declared North Korea to be part of the axis of evil, right, along with Iran and Iraq, and proceeded to invade Iraq. And that's when North Korea pulled out. I think this is a terrible missed opportunity, and I have to wonder, I think Donald Trump wants this agreement, wanted it. I think it may be his advisors.
Okay, I also want to bring in one more guest. Myung-Ku Kang, he is in New York, a professor of political science at Baruch College, City University of New York. Thanks very much for joining us. I want you to hear from the DPRK what they had to say about this. We heard Donald Trump say that North Korea wanted the sanctions removed. Here is the DPRK's response.
If the U.S. removes partial sanctions, that is, removes sanctions that hamper the civilian economy and livelihoods of our people in particular, we will permanently and completely dismantle all the nuclear production facilities in the Yongbyon area, including plutonium and uranium, in the presence of U.S. experts and technicians from both countries.
Myung-Ku, I want to ask you, arguably China knows more about what is going on inside the DPRK than any other nation. What is your take on this, he said, he said?
I think basically that President Trump wanted a kind of grand slam, home run, completely reversed, you know, politics going on here in the United States. As you know, yesterday, all day long here in the United States, you know, broadcasting the Michael Cohen's, you know, testimony in Congress. Mm-hmm. And then I think President Trump was fully aware of the significance of the testimony and the political impact in domestic politics going on here in the United States.
Just to bring our viewers up to date, Michael Cohen, of course, was Donald Trump's personal lawyer who has now turned against him and gave day-long testimony that was covered in the United States. So Donald Trump overseas, 12 hours difference, had a chance to watch all that in between these important sessions.
Right, so I think that he wanted a kind of not just solo home run or, you know, double, if I use a baseball analogy. Mm-hmm. So he wanted, as I told you, you know, the grand slam home run. But as we can see that, you know, at the operational level negotiation team, they already reached an agreement. As Mr. Baker highlighted, you know, North Korea seems to have suggested that they're going to freeze the Yongbyon nuclear complex site and then freezing the existing nuclear missile programs. But President Trump seems to have wanted more, you know, which he can highlight that North Korean Kim Jong-un completely surrendered to the American demand, and he could advocate as a kind of political victory against the dictatorship here in the United States and to the rest of the world. I think that seems to be the content.
David, I want to bring you in. We were chatting earlier. It seems that the U.S. negotiators perhaps could have played down expectations. What do you make of all this? How does Donald Trump come out of this? And is there a winner?
In my opinion, the winner would be Donald Trump, because everyone was saying prior to this that he's going to give too much away, that he'll do anything for a deal. And I think that gave Kim the perception that he could make any demands that he wanted and they would be met. In fact, I think since he was ultimately offered a bad deal, I think Trump's willingness to walk away was not only the correct thing to do, but now sets the stage for a different set of negotiations going forward in the future.
Victor, was it a bad deal? And secondly, we know Chinese officials are out trying to manage expectations as well. I want to hear what the foreign ministry had to say. Listen to this very quickly.
We hope that the DPRK and the U.S. will continue the dialogue, show sincerity, respect, and accommodate each other's legitimate concerns, jointly promote denuclearization and the formation of a peaceful mechanism on the Korean Peninsula. China will continue to play a constructive role in this regard.
Well, Victor, if you think about it, if you look back to Kim Jong-un's grandfather and father, having nuclear weapons is part of that family's legacy. Can you understand why they are reluctant to give them up? And secondly, about what David said, was this a bad deal coming from the DPRK?
Well, first of all, what happened in Hanoi is a complete letdown and disappointment for all the parties involved, including us here in China. We, of course, would like to see a positive outcome, the United States and DPRK reach an agreement, eventually resulting in denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. However, pragmatically speaking, what happened should have been predicted and should have been actually expected. Why? Because the DPRK government and the United States government cannot be further away in how they define denuclearization and how do they define what steps will be needed to achieve denuclearization. If we take what the DPRK government's feedback right now as they are, and then you can say what they probably want to do is so-called destruction of the production facilities, but in reality, a total and complete denuclearization will require much more than that. That is, all the existing weapons and related materials and facilities should also be disposed of. And I think under the current way of approaching this negotiation between the two countries, I personally believe they can talk and talk and talk, improve mutual trust of each other, but eventually denuclearization, as we all understand it, will not happen. I would say now it is the time for President Trump and the U.S. government and DPRK and its leader, for example, to really sit back and think about what do they really mean by denuclearization and what is the better way.
And what is realistic about moving forward?
Between the United States and DPRK, they cannot achieve denuclearization. You need to have a better structure. You need to bring in more parties involved to really achieve denuclearization, which is the utmost thing on the Korean Peninsula and to all the parties related to this situation, and which is the real juggler of the whole situation.
Right. Myung-Koo, I want to talk about that, bringing in more parties. We know China is invested, so is the Republic of Korea. Moon Jae-in has been very involved in the discussions. And Japan, according to the most recent poll I've seen from Pew, shows that 73% of its residents see the DPRK as a major nuclear threat, only 68% of people in the Republic of Korea. So how does this play out with all this concern in the area? What does it mean for the DPRK's neighbors?
Currently the South Korea and then the Japan relationship is really estranged. And then immediately after the no deal, from Hanoi, Prime Minister Abe expressed his welcoming that, no deal is better than a bad deal kind of situation. But from the South Korean, presidential office announced that a little bit disappointment. At the same time, they didn't want to lose some optimistic view in terms of improving the current DPRK and U.S. relations. So we can see that some split or conflict between the two countries, South Korea and Japan, makes it a little bit difficult U.S. government position in terms of coordinating multilateral approach in dealing with the North Korean nuclear threat. I think South Korean people's perception of North Korean threat, and then as you pointed out, Japanese people's perception of North Korean threat and their definition of denuclearization seems to be very different. Of course, here in the United States, the definition of denuclearization is different. So the overall, this kind of different perceptions of the threat and the definition of denuclearization makes it really difficult in multilateral coordination. But I think multilateral deliberative coordination, that should be the path we need to pursue from now.
David, I want to talk about that. If the denuclearization, it does mean something different to Kim Jong-un than it does to the other parties involved. In fact, as he was quoted as saying, he believes it means that there shouldn't be missiles in the Republic of Korea. And he also has to look at what happened to Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Does that weigh on the DPRK leader?
I think it does. And but I think his definition of denuclearization also includes that that when the DPRK gets rid of its nuclear weapons, so does the United States, which of course is a ridiculous demand, given that the United States is recognized as one of the five nuclear weapon states authorized to legally possess nuclear weapons under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Mm-hmm. I think that going back to the issue of the, this is ultimately a regional issue, first of all, and that Japan and South Korea have some obvious concerns, but if they can't see the need to work together closely here, they're truly missing the ball.
Brian, I want to bring you back in, because we've now had two high-profile summits within, 8 or 9 months, and both times Donald Trump has walked in and been very loquacious talking about how he's going to move forward and all these possibilities, perhaps ending the war with the Korean War. Where are we now, and has this been a huge disappointment?
I think it's a big setback for Donald Trump. I think it's a bigger setback for the people in Korea, the North and South, who actually want this Korean War to end. I have a different perspective, I think, than some of your other guests. This war has gone on for 69 years. Economic sanctions are an insidious form of warfare designed to deprive people of food and medicine and that which is necessary to sustain life. This is a big setback. And the real situation here is this. The North Korean government is not trying to have a nuclear war with the United States or anyone else. They've been trying to lift sanctions for the last 25 years. We have a situation where there was a very good deal on the table, the shutdown of a big part of the DPRK nuclear facility, the suspension of their nuclear weapons tests, and a moratorium. This was a turn down because I think there is not real willpower or desire for a settlement on the Korean issue in Washington. It's Donald Trump seemed to be the only person within the Washington establishment who was promoting this deal. And again, it's not because there's an imminent danger posed by the DPRK. I think this is a terrible development. I think, in fact, it's going to be very hard for Donald Trump to have a third summit. I think the people who were the naysayers are quite happy that this collapsed. But I think, again, for people, for human beings on the Korean Peninsula, and for all of us who care about peace, this is quite a big setback.
David, I know you want to jump in here. If we think back before these two summits, these are two nations that were speaking very harshly to each other. Is Brian right that there was no threat? And did Donald Trump walk away from what could have been some kind of deal?
Well, I don't think he has walked away permanently. I think he has simply let Kim know that the parameters for the current negotiation are unacceptable, and he's got to be more reasonable. The problem is that the Kim family regime, which is much more like a mafia cult, consistently knows how to play this long game, and it's a con game where they continually get the other negotiating partner to give more while they give nothing. And President Trump is not falling into that trap. And it's a hard one not to fall into because the Kim family regime has played this game successfully now for years and years and years. The sanctions have got to stay in place. They are hurting. They're having an effect. And there has to be something concrete done in order to begin lifting those sanctions, such as the declaration of nuclear weapons, letting inspectors in, verifiably destroying nuclear weapons, verifiably shutting down facilities. That are real important facilities, not a test site they're not using anymore. And the problem is, remember, they have probably gained what they need to know in their nuclear testing program. So it's in many ways an easy give for them to stop the testing.
We have a couple of our panelists shaking their head no at all this. Myung Ko, I think you want to weigh in as well. Is David right here?
Yeah, I want to jump in. I mean, President Trump definitely needs to talk with the Congress. I mean, President Trump, if he wants to make, for instance, third summit meeting or persuade North Korea to take a deal or a demand from the American government, President Trump definitely needs to make some reasonable level of consensus or support from the Congress. So talking here in the United States and persuading the Democratic politicians and then to a reasonable level of consensus about the definition of denuclearization or the coming deal with North Korea. But as we know well, President Trump did not seem to have informed the details, the negotiations to those Congress members in the United States. If that's the case, Congress would not allow any kind of substantive ratification or deals with North Korea. And the North Korean leaders and policymakers are fully aware of the domestic situation going on in the United States. If that's the case, they would not take the deal because they cannot trust the U.S. government. Hypothetically, if the regime is replaced, as Mr. Baker pointed out, from Clinton administration to Bush administration, at that time, Bush administration did not take the deal at all. I think it's somewhat similar worry or concern can be quite serious to the North Korean perspective.
We've talked a lot about what President Trump has said. Let's hear from him on what he thinks is the core issue.
For the sake of South Korea, for the sake of
Japan and, frankly, for the sake of China. I was talking to President Xi, who really is a man that gets the respect of a lot of people. I say, you can't love having a nuclear state right next to China. And he doesn't. He really doesn't. He would like to see that problem solved, too.
Well, I think that one thing that hasn't been said here is the Chinese government has been very consistent for years saying there needs to be a dialogue. It needs to involve not only the United States, but countries in that region. Victor, what do you think about that, and where does China go from here?
I think China was there. China has always been there. China is here, and China will be indispensable in any final solution of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. China is different from the United States in the sense that China has no eagerness to claim any credit for trying to achieve this denuclearization or eventually delivery denuclearization. China is very happy to let other country, for example, try to monopolize all the credit to that country or to that particular leader in that country. I think credit or not is secondary. The real thing is to get the job done, and that is the well-defined denuclearization. Secondly, I think it's also time to ask the United States to again and again reflect on what is the fundamental reason that DPRK all these years came up with nuclear weapons. I personally believe the DPRK government or the people do not need a nuclear weapon. They need the nuclear weapon, and they've developed the nuclear weapon. Now they refuse to really achieve the complete destruction of the nuclear weapon because they fear for their survival and they fear for their national security. And we need to deal with that as the most fundamental reason rather than purely looking at the nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, as far as I can tell, are the symptom. They are not the real cause of the decades-long problem that we are now faced with. So we would need a new approach to how we can all work together to achieve the denuclearization issue. The negotiations as they structure now, in my judgment, cannot deliver the real denuclearization at all, no matter how hard DPRK and the United States try and try again.
David, we've heard Victor say that it's a symptom, not the problem. But think about this from Kim Jong-un's point of view. You have tens of thousands of U.S. troops. You've had missiles pointed at Pyongyang for generations now. You have military games that have gone off the coast of the DPRK for years and years and years. Don't you think Victor has a degree of logic there?
I suppose that you could say that North Korea could perceive it that way, but the United States has no intention of attacking North Korea. The troops are stationed there pursuant to the agreement in the Korean armistice, which of course was not resolved with the peace treaty, just essentially a cessation of hostilities. So as a technical matter, the two states are still at war. I do think a couple things I just wanted to comment on. One of the guests noted that, we don't know if this would be ratified. Let's remember that, of course, the Iran deal wasn't ratified. It wasn't even a treaty. So that's what President Obama did. Now, I don't have any knowledge or insight into how President Trump intends this agreement to go, whether it will be a political handshake like the Iran nuclear agreement or whether it would be a legally binding treaty. We'll have to see. But the fact of the matter is that these kinds of details that the last gentleman spoke about are not going to be worked out in a meeting between Trump and Kim. They're going to be worked out at the working level. For instance, I was one of the negotiators on the U.S.-India nuclear deal. Those are the kinds of work, the working level staff from the agencies in the U.S. government, along with the DPRK professional working level personnel, will actually negotiate the details of this treaty. That's not going to be resolved between Trump and Kim.
Brian, we're all looking at this from a very academic standpoint. We're far away. You were there on the ground. Was there a sense of disappointment the way this ended? And how do you think that the neighboring countries to the DPRK are reacting?
I think there was shock. I think there was disappointment. People were very, very surprised. I was in the hall when it sort of all unraveled there. And there was a lot of disappointment. I think there's a lot of disappointment here in Vietnam. Donald Trump had made the point that Vietnam, which was at war with the United States, now is at peace with the United States. It's a thriving country, and the same could happen with the DPRK. A lot of people thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because, of course, it does make a lot of sense. A bottom line here is that there's an imbalance of power. It's not because DPRK is a great nuclear menace. I think DPRK wants the sanctions lifted. I think it's time to lift the sanctions. There's a logical incongruity in the position of your other guest. You can't have a country that you are at war with, then you can't demand that country then disarm. You have to declare peace, and that was point number one of the Singapore summit. Declare peace, normalize relations, and then denuclearization and real peace can come, but it won't be the other way around.
Myung-Koo, I want you to hear what the Republic of Korea is saying tonight, because it's also very important. While the two sides have agreed to walk away, they're not walking away in anger. There's still the hope that they can meet down the road. So hear what the RRK has to say.
트럼프 대통령과 김정은 국무위원장이
We regret that no deal was reached at a summit between Chairman Kim Jong-un and President Trump, but it seems clear that the two sides had made meaningful progress.
Okay, they've made meaningful progress, but can international pressure help these two sides get back to the table? Myung-Koo?
It's a little bit tricky to, you know, to predict whether international pressure can work on two sides get back together, you know, for more negotiations. But my hunch is that from the North Korean perspective, going back to, for instance, 2017, launching missile and the nuclear test, like that, I think if that's the case, North Korea will lose more. So the North Korean Kim Jong-un regime will try to, you know, lose less under this kind of situation. And then from the American side, I think engaging with North Korea, and then while we are, you know, negotiation is going on, if President Trump is correct, he delivered the message that while the negotiation going on, Kim Jong-un promised that, you know, North Korea would not to missile or nuclear test. So if that's the case, some status quo and ongoing negotiations can happen, not going back to the 2017, you know, escalating into a full-blown crisis. I think that would be the situation. But in terms of international pressure, I think the U.S. government needs to more closely talk with all these, you know, governments, you know, not only South Korea, definitely, and then Japan and then China. And so multilateral, more deliberative and a cooperative coordination in dealing with, you know, current, you know, ongoing bilateral negotiation between the two countries. I think that will produce more stable and the peaceful, you know, consequences in the end.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you all. That's all the time we have. We could continue to talk about this all night, I presume. But I want to thank you very much for your information.
That was from the program The Heat from China's global television network, CGTN, being guest hosted there by journalist Sean Calebs. As one might imagine, how President Trump conducts nuclear talks with another country was being watched very closely in Tehran. Iran's press TV's program, The Debate, also discussed the breakup of talks on Thursday. This was British publisher and editor Marcus Papadopoulos speaking from London on Thursday in reply to the question, why do you think the talks failed?
On the contrary, I'm of the opinion that the meeting was a success. The fact that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, whose respective countries have harbored bitter feelings towards each other for more than half a century, have met for a second time, is something to rejoice about, because now that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un and their respective administrations are speaking with each other, this on its own has resulted in a reduction of tension on the Korean Peninsula. It wasn't so long ago that there were warlike words coming from Washington and Pyongyang, but now that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un have met each other, not just once, but twice, is something that should be celebrated. As I said, the tension on the Korean Peninsula has been much reduced because of these meetings. And the people who are labeling this second meeting as a failure, they do not understand the complexities of international relations. The fact that there is communication, there is dialogue, has meant that the tension on the Korean Peninsula is much reduced. That is something that we should rejoice.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.